I was awakened by a shaft of light rising between two snowy peaks in the distance. Looking around, I realized that Yen was gone. I jumped up and searched the immediate area, my body aching all over. Yen was nowhere I could see. Damn, I thought. I had no way of knowing where I was. A deep wave of anxiety rushed through me. I waited for 30 minutes, looking out at the brown, rocky hills with little valleys of green grass, and still he had not returned. Then I stood up again and noticed for the first time that down the slope, about 400 feet, was a gravel road. I grabbed my satchel and walked down through the rocks until I reached the road and then headed north. As best I could remember, that was the direction back toward Lhasa. I hadn't gone a half mile before I noticed that there were 4 or 5 people less than 100 paces behind me heading in the same direction. I immediately left the road and moved well up into the rocks so that I would be hidden but could still watch them pass. When they reached me, I realized that it was a family made up of an old man, and a woman of about 30, and 2 teenage boys. They were carrying large sacks, and the younger man was pulling a cart filled with possessions. They looked like refugees. I thought about approaching them, and at least finding out which way to go, but I decided against it. I was afraid they might report me later, and so I let them go by. I waited another 20 minutes, then carefully walked in the same direction. For about 2 miles, the road weaved its way through the small rocky hills and plateaus until in the distance, at the top of one of the hills, I could see a monastery. I moved off the road and climbed through the rocks until I was about 200 yards below it. It was made of sandy-colored brick with the flat roof painted brown and had 2 wings, one on each side of a main building. I could see no movement, and at first I thought the place was empty. But then the door at the front opened, and I saw a monk adorned in a bright red robe come out and begin to work in a garden near a lone tree to the right of the building. He looked harmless enough, but I decided to take no chances. I walked back to the gravel road, crossed it, and made a wide berth around the left side of the monastery until I was well past. Then I carefully proceeded up the road again, stopping only to take off my parka. The sun was beating down now, and it was surprisingly warm. After about a mile, as I was about to crest a small rise in the road, I heard something. I ran into the rocks and listened. At first, I thought it was a bird, but slowly I realized it was someone talking far in the distance. Who? Taking great care, I moved up through the rocks until I had a higher position, then peeked over at the small valley below. My heart froze. Below me was a gravel crossroads at which were parked 3 military jeeps. Perhaps a dozen soldiers stood around smoking cigarettes and talking. I backed away, keeping low, and walked the way I had come until I found a place to hide between 2 large boulders. From there, I heard something else in the distance out beyond the roadblock. It was a low drone at first, and then a whirling, clapping sound I recognized. It was a helicopter. Panicked, I ran through the rocks as fast as I could away from the road. I crossed a small stream and slipped, drenching my pants up to the knees. I jumped up and started to run again when my foot slipped on one of the rocks and I careened down a hill, ripping my pants and gouging my leg. Struggling to my feet, I kept running, looking for a better place to hide. As the helicopter closed, I bounded over another small rise and was looking back when someone grabbed me and pulled me down into a small gorge. It was Yen. We lay perfectly still as the large helicopter flew directly over us. "It's a V-9, Yen said. His face looked panicked, but I could tell he was also curious. "Why did you leave where we were camped?" he half shouted. "You left me," I responded. "I was gone less than an hour. You should have waited." The fear and anger exploded in me. "Waited? Why didn't you tell me you were going?" I wasn't through, but I could hear the helicopter churning in the distance. "What are we going to do?" I asked Yen. "We can't stay here." "Back to the monastery," he said. "That's where I was before." I nodded, then raised up and looked for the helicopter. Luckily, it was veering off to the north. At the same time, Something else caught my eye. It was the monk I had seen earlier, moving down the ditch toward us. He walked up to us and said something to Yen in Tibetan, then looked at me. "Come, please," he said in English, grabbing me, pulling me toward the monastery. When we arrived, we first walked through a side courtyard gate and passed many Tibetans standing with bags and various belongings. Some of them looked very poor. Then we reached the main building of the monastery, and the monk opened the large wooden doors and led us through an entry room where more Tibetans were gathered. As we walked by, I recognized one group. It was the family I had let pass me on the road earlier. They looked at me with warm eyes. Yen saw me looking at them and questioned me about it, and I explained that I had seen them back on the road. "They were there to lead you here," Yen said, "but you were too afraid to follow the synchronicity." He glanced at me sternly and then continued to follow the monk into a small study with bookcases and desks and several prayer wheels. We were then seated around an ornately carved wooden table where the monk and Yen carried on an extensive conversation in Tibetan. "Let me see your leg," another monk asked in English from behind us. He carried a small basket filled with white bandages and several dropper bottles. Yin's face lit up. "You two know each other?" I asked. "Please," the monk said, offering his hand while bowing slightly. "I am Jampa." Yin leaned toward me. "Jampa has been with the Lama Rigdon for over 10 years. "Who is Lama Rigdon?" Both Jampa and Yin looked at each other as though not sure how much to tell me. Finally, Yin said, "I mentioned the legends to you earlier. Lama Rigdon understands the legends more than any other person. He is one of the foremost experts on Shambhala." "Tell me exactly what has happened," Jampa said to me as he dabbed some kind of salve on my scraped leg. I looked at Yen, who nodded for me to comply. "I must present what has happened to you to the Lama," Jampa clarified. I proceeded to tell him everything that had occurred since arriving at Lhasa. When I finished, Jampa looked at me. "What about before you came to Tibet? What had happened?" I told him about my neighbor's daughter and about Will. He and Yin looked at each other. "And what have you been thinking?" Jampa asked. "I've been thinking that I'm in over my head here," I said. "I'm planning to head to the airport." "No, that's not what I mean," Jampa said quickly. "This morning, when you discovered that Yin had left, what was your attitude, your state of mind?" "I was scared. I just knew the Chinese would be on me in minutes. I tried to figure out how to get back to Lhasa." Jampa turned and looked at Yen, frowning. "He doesn't know about the prayer fields." Yen shook his head and looked away. "We've discussed it," I said, "but I'm not sure how it matters. What do you know about these helicopters? Are they after us?" Jampa only smiled and told me not to worry, that I would be safe here. We were interrupted by several other monks delivering soup, bread, and tea. As we ate, my mind seemed to clear and I began to assess the situation. I wanted to know everything about what was going on, right now. I looked at Jampa with determination, and he returned my gaze with a profound warmth. "I know you have many questions," Jampa said. "Let me tell you as much as I can. We are a special sect here in Tibet, not typical. For many centuries, we have held the belief that Shambhala is a real place. We also hold the knowledge of the legends, verbal wisdom as old as the Kalachakra, which is devoted to the integration of all religious truth. Many of our lamas are in touch with Shambhala through their dreams. A few months ago, your friend, Will, began to show up in Lama Rigdon's dreams of Shambhala. A short time after that, Will was led to this very monastery. Lama Rigdon agreed to see him and found out Will was also having dreams of Shambhala." "What did Will tell him?" I asked. "Where did he go?" He shook his head. "I am afraid you must wait and see if Lama Rigdon will give you that information himself." I looked at Yen, and he attempted to smile. What about the Chinese? I asked Jampa. How are they involved? Jampa shrugged. We don't know. Perhaps they know something about what is happening. I nodded. There's one more thing, Jampa said. Apparently, in all the dreams there appears another person, an American. Jampa paused and bowed slightly. Your friend Will wasn't sure, but he thought it was you. After bathing and changing clothes in the room Jampa had provided, I walked out into the back courtyard. Several monks were working in a vegetable garden as though the Chinese were of no concern. I looked out at the mountains and surveyed the sky. No helicopters anywhere. Would you like to sit on the bench up there? A voice spoke from behind me. I turned and saw Yen walking out the door. I nodded, and we walked up several terraces filled with ornamental plants and vegetables until we reached a sitting area facing an elaborate Buddhist shrine. A large mountain range framed the horizon behind us, but toward the south, we had a panoramic view of the countryside for miles. Many people were walking on the roads or pulling carts. Where is the Lama? I asked. I don't know, Yen replied. He has not yet agreed to see you. Why not? Yen shook his head. I don't know. Do you think he knows where Will is? Again, Yen shook his head. Do you think the Chinese are still looking for us? I asked. Yen only shrugged, looking out into the distance. I am sorry, my energy is so bad, he said. Please, don't let it influence you. It's just that my anger overwhelms me. Since 1954, the Chinese have systematically set out to destroy the Tibetan culture. Look at those people walking out there. Many of them are farmers who are displaced because of economic initiatives the Chinese have mandated. Others are nomads who are starving because these policies have interrupted their way of life. He clenched both fists. The Chinese are doing the same thing Stalin did in Manchuria, importing thousands of outsiders, in this case ethnic Chinese, into Tibet to change the culture balance and institute Chinese ways. They demand that our schools teach only the Chinese language. The people outside the gates of the monastery, I asked, why do they come here? Lama Rigdon and the monks are working to help the poor who are having the worst time with the transition of their culture. That is why the Chinese have left him alone. He helps solve the problems without agitating the populace against them. Yin said that this reflected a mild resentment against the Lama, and immediately he apologized. No, he said, I didn't mean to imply that the Lama is cooperating too much. It's just that what the Chinese are doing is despicable. He clenched his fists again and hit his knees. Many thought at first that the Chinese government would be respectful of Tibetan ways, that we could exist within the Chinese nation without losing everything. But the government is bent on destroying us. This is clear now, and we must begin to make it more difficult on them. You mean, try to fight them? I asked. Yin, you know you can't win that. I know, he said. I just get so angry when I think of what they are doing. Someday, the warriors of Shambhala will ride out and defeat these monsters of evil. What? It is a prophecy among my people. He looked at me and shook his head. I know. I must work on my anger. It collapses my prayer field. Abruptly, he stood up and added, I'll go ask Jampa if he has talked with the Lama. Please, excuse me. He bowed slightly and left. For a while, I looked out at the Tibetan landscape, trying to comprehend fully the damage the Chinese occupation had done. At one point, I even thought I heard another helicopter. But it was too far away to be sure. I knew Yin's anger was justified, and I thought for several more minutes about the realities of the political situation in Tibet. The thought of asking for a phone came back to mind, and I wondered how hard it would be to place an international call. I was about to get up and head inside when I realized I felt tired. so I took a couple of deep breaths and tried to focus on the beauty around me. The snow-capped mountains and the green and brown colors of the landscape were stark and beautiful, and the sky was a rich blue with only a few clouds along the western horizon. As I gazed out, I noticed that the two monks who were several tiers down below me were staring intently up in my direction. I glanced behind me to see if there was something up there, but I could see nothing unusual. I smiled back in their direction. After a few minutes, one of them walked up the stone steps toward me, carrying a basket full of hand tools. When he reached me, he nodded politely and began to weed a bed of flowers 20 feet to my right. Several minutes later, he was joined by another monk, who began digging as well. Occasionally, they would look over at me with inquiring eyes and deferential nods. I took more deep breaths and focused on the far distance again, thinking about what Yen had said concerning his prayer field. He was worried that his anger against the Chinese collapsed his energy. What did he mean by that? Suddenly, I began to feel the warmth of the sun and to sense its radiance more consciously, feeling a certain peacefulness I hadn't felt since coming here. I took another breath with my eyes closed and perceived something else, an unusually sweet fragrance like a bouquet of flowers. My first thought was that the monks had clipped some of the blooms off the plants they were working on and had placed them near me. I opened my eyes and looked, but there were no flowers close by. I felt for a breeze that might have blown the fragrance over toward me, but there was none stirring. I noticed the monks had dropped their tools and were staring intensely at me with wide eyes and their mouths half open as though they had seen something strange. Again, I looked behind me, trying to figure out what was going on. Upon noticing that they had disturbed me, they quickly gathered up their tools and basket and almost ran down the path toward the monastery. I followed them with my eyes for a moment, watching their red robes flip and sway as they glanced back at me to see if I was watching. As soon as I walked down and entered the monastery, I knew something was abuzz. The monks were all scurrying about and whispering to one another. I walked down a hallway and into my own room, planning on asking Jampa for the use of a phone. My mood was better, but I was again questioning my own sense of self-preservation. I was being drawn further into what was happening here instead of trying to get out of this country. Who knew what the Chinese might do if I was caught? Did they know my name? It might even be too late to leave by air. I was about to get up and look for Jampa when he burst into the room. "The Lama has agreed to see you," he said. "This is a great honor. Don't worry, he speaks perfect English." I nodded, feeling a little nervous. Jampa was standing at the door looking expectant. "I am to escort you now," he said. I got up and followed Jampa as he led me through a very large room with high ceilings and into a smaller room on the other side. 5 or 6 monks holding prayer wheels and white scarves watched with anticipation as we walked up toward the front and sat down. Yin waved from the far corner. "This is the greeting room," Jampa said. The interior of the room was wooden and painted a light blue. Handcrafted murals and mandalas adorned the walls. We waited for a few minutes, and then the Lama entered. He was taller than most of the other monks, but was dressed in a red robe exactly like the ones they wore. After looking at everyone in the room very deliberately, he summoned Jampa forward. They touched foreheads, and he whispered something in Jampa's ear. Jampa immediately turned and gestured to all the other monks to follow him out of the room. Yin, too, began to leave, but as he did, he glanced at me and nodded slightly, a gesture I took as support for my impending conversation. Many of the monks handed me their scarves and nodded excitedly. When the room was empty, the Lama motioned for me to come forward and sit in a tiny straight-backed chair to his right. I bowed slightly as I came up and sat down. "Thank you for seeing me," I said. He nodded and smiled, looking me over for a long time. "Could I ask you about my friend, Wilson James?" I finally inquired. "Do you know where he is?" "What is your understanding of Shambhala?" the Lama asked in return. I guess I've always thought of it as an imaginary place, a fantasy. You know, like Shangri-La. He cocked his head and replied matter-of-factly, It is a real place on Earth that exists as part of the human community. Why has no one ever discovered where it is? And why do so many prominent Buddhists speak of Shambhala as a way of life, a mentality? Because Shambhala does represent a way of being and living. It can be spoken of accurately in that manner, but it is also an actual location where real people have achieved this way of being in community with each other. Have you been there? No. No, I have not yet been called. Then, how can you be so sure? Because I have dreamed of Shambhala many times, as have many other adepts on Earth. We compare our dreams, and they are so similar, we know this must be a real place. And we hold the sacred knowledge, the legends, that explain our relationship to this sacred community. What is that relationship? We are to preserve the knowledge while we are waiting for the time when Shambhala will come out and make itself known to all peoples. Yen told me that some believe that the warriors of Shambhala will eventually arrive to defeat the Chinese. Yen's anger is very dangerous for him. He's wrong then? He is speaking from the human viewpoint that sees defeat in terms of war and physical fighting. Exactly how this prophecy will come true is still unknown. We will have to first understand Shambhala, but we know that this will be a different kind of battle. I found that last statement cryptic, but his manner was so compassionate that I felt awe rather than confusion. We believe, Lama Rigdon continued, that the time when the way of Shambhala shall be known in the world is very close. Lama, how do you know this? Again, because of our dreams. Your friend Will has been here, as you undoubtedly have already heard. This we took as a great sign because we have earlier dreamed of him. He has smelled the fragrance and heard the utterance. I was taken aback. What kind of fragrance? He smiled. The one you yourself smelled earlier today. Now everything made sense. The way the monks had reacted and the Lama's decision to see me. You are also being called, he added. The sending of the fragrance is a rare thing. I have seen it occur only twice. Once when I was with my teacher, and again when your friend, Will, was here. Now it has happened again with you. I had not known whether to see you or not. It is very dangerous to speak of these things trivially. Have you also heard the cry? No, I said. I don't understand what that is. It is also a call from Shambhala. Just keep listening for a special sound. When you hear it, you will know what it is. Lama, I'm not sure I want to go anywhere. It seems very dangerous here for me. The Chinese seem to know who I am. I think I want to go back to the United States as soon as possible. Can you just tell me where I might find Will? Is he somewhere close? The Lama shook his head, looking very sad. No, I'm afraid he has committed to go on. I was silent, and for a long moment the Lama just looked at me. There is something else you must know, he said. It is very clear from the dreams that without you, Will could not survive this attempt. For him to succeed, you will have to be there as well. A wave of fear ran through me, and I looked away. This is not what I wanted to hear. The legends say, the Lama went on, that in Shambhala, each generation has a certain destiny that is publicly known and talked about. The same is true in human cultures outside of Shambhala. Sometimes, great strength and clarity can be gained by looking at the courage and intent of the generation that came before us. I wondered where he was going with this. Is your father alive? He asked. I shook my head. He died a couple of years ago. Did he serve in the Great War of the 1940s? Yes, I replied, he did. Was he in the fighting? Yes, during most of the war. Did he tell you of his most fearful situation? His question took me back to discussions with my father during my youth. I thought for a moment. Probably the landing in Normandy in 1944 at Omaha Beach. Ah, yes, the Lama said. I have seen your American movies about this landing. Have you seen them? Yes, I have, I said. They moved me very much. They told of the soldiers' fear and courage, he went on. Yes. Do you think you could have done such things? I don't know. I don't see how they did it. Perhaps it was easier for them because it was the calling for a whole generation. On some level, they all sensed it. The ones who fought, the ones who made the arms, the ones who provided the food. They saved the whole world at the time of its greatest peril. He waited as though he expected me to ask a question, but I just looked at him. The calling of your generation is different, he said. You too must save the world, but you must do so in a different way. You must understand that inside you is a great power that can be cultivated and extended, a mental energy that has always been called prayer. So I've been told, I said, but I guess I still don't know how to use it. To this he smiled and stood up, looking at me with a twinkle in his eye. Yes, he said, I know, but you will. You will. I laid down on the cot in my room and thought about what the Lama had told me. He had ended the conversation abruptly, waving off my remaining questions. Go and rest now, he had said, calling in several monks by ringing a loud bell. We will talk again tomorrow. Later, both Jampa and Yen had made me recount everything the Lama had said, but the truth was that the Lama had left me with more questions than answers. I still did not know where Will had gone or what the call of Shambhala really meant. It all sounded fanciful and dangerous. Yin and Jampa had refused to discuss any of these questions. We had spent the rest of the evening eating and looking out at the landscape before going to bed early. Now I found myself staring up at the ceiling, unable to sleep, thoughts whirling in my head. I replayed my whole experience in Tibet in my mind several times and then finally drifted into a fitful sleep. I dreamed of running through the crowds of Lhasa, seeking sanctuary at one of the monasteries. The monks at the door took one look at me and shut the door. Soldiers pursued. I ran down dark lanes and alleyways without hope until, at the end of the street, I looked to my right and saw a lighted area similar to the ones I had seen before. As I moved closer, the light gradually disappeared, but ahead of me was a gate. The soldiers were coming around the corner behind me, and I dashed through the gate and found myself in an icy landscape. I woke up with a start. Where was I? Slowly, I recognized the room and got to my feet and walked to the window. Dawn was just breaking toward the east, and I tried to shake off the dream and go back to bed, an idea that proved to be totally fruitless. I was wide awake. Pulling on a pair of pants and a jacket, I walked downstairs and outside to the courtyard by the vegetable gardens and sat down on an ornate metal bench. As I stared out toward the sunrise, I heard something behind me. Turning, I saw the figure of a man moving toward me from the monastery. It was Lama Rigdon. I stood up, and he bowed deeply. "You are up early," he said. "I hope you slept well." "Yes," I said, watching him as he walked forward and sprinkled a handful of grain in the fountain pond for the fish. The water swirled as they consumed the food. "What were your dreams?" he said without looking at me. I told him about the chase and seeing the lighted area. He looked at me in amazement. "Have you had this experience in your waking life as well?" he asked. "Several times on this trip," I said. "Lama, what is going on?" He smiled and sat on a bench opposite me. "You are being helped by the Dakini." "I don't understand. What are the Dakini?" Will left Yin a note in which he referred to the Dakini, but I'd never heard of them before that. "They are from the spiritual world. They usually appear as females, but they can take any form they wish. In the West, they are known as angels, but they are even more mysterious than most think. I am afraid they are truly known only by those in Shambhala. The legends say that they move with the light of Shambhala." He paused and looked at me deeply. "Have you decided whether to answer this call?" "I wouldn't know how to proceed," I said. "The legends will guide you. They say that the time for Shambhala to be known will be recognized because many people will begin to understand how those in Shambhala live, the truth behind the prayer energy. Prayer is not a power that is realized only when we sit down and decide to pray in a particular situation. Prayer works at these times, of course, but prayer is also working at other times."
"You're talking about a constant prayer field?"
"Yes. Everything we expect, good or bad, conscious or unconscious, we are helping to bring into being. Our prayer is an energy or power that emanates out from us in all directions. In most people who think in ordinary ways, this power is very weak and contradictory. But in others who seem to achieve a lot in life and who are very creative and successful, this field of energy is strong, although it is still usually unconscious. Most of those in this group have a strong field because they grew up in an environment where they learned to expect success and more or less take it for granted. They had strong role models whom they emulated. But the legends say that soon all people will learn about this power and understand that our ability to use this energy can be strengthened and extended. I have told you this to explain how to answer the call of Shambhala. To find this holy place, you must systematically extend your energy until you emanate enough creative strength to go there. The procedure for doing this is set forth in the legends and involves three important steps. There is also a fourth step, but it is known in its completeness only to those in Shambhala. That is why finding Shambhala is so difficult. Even if one successfully extends one's energy through the first three steps, one must have help in order to actually find the way to Shambhala. The Dakini must open the gateway.
You call the Dakini spiritual beings. Do you mean souls that are in the afterlife who are acting as guides for us?
No. The Dakini are other beings who act to awaken and guard humans. They are not and never were human.
Are they the same as angels?
The Lama smiled. They are what they are. One reality. Each religion has a different name for them, just as each religion has a different way of describing God and how humans should live. But in every religion, the experience of God, the energy of love, is exactly the same. Each religion has its own history of this relationship and way of speaking about it. But there is only one divine source. It is the same with angels.
So you aren't strictly Buddhist?
Our sect and the legends we hold have their roots in Buddhism, but we stand for the synthesis of all religions. We believe each has its truth that must be incorporated with all the others. It is possible to do this without losing the sovereignty or basic truth of one's own traditional way. I would also call myself a Christian, for instance,
and a Jew or a Muslim. We believe those in Shambhala also work for an integration of all religious truth. They work for this in the same spirit that the Dalai Lama makes the Kalachakra initiations known to anyone who has a sincere heart. I just looked at him, trying to take it all in. Don't try to understand everything now, the Lama said. Just know that the integration of all religious truth is important if the force of prayer energy is to grow large enough to resolve the dangers posed by those who fear. Also, remember that the Dakini are real. What makes them act to help us? I asked. The Lama took a deep breath, thinking deeply. The question seemed to be a point of frustration for him. I have worked my whole life to understand this question, he said finally. But I must admit that I do not know. I think that it is the great secret of Shambhala and will not be understood until Shambhala is understood. But you think, I interjected, that the Dakini are helping me? Yes, he said firmly, and your friend will. What about Yin? How does he figure in all this? Yin met your friend Will at this monastery. Yin has also dreamed of you, but in a different context from myself or the other lamas. Yin was educated in England and is very familiar in Western ways. He is to be your guide, although he is very reluctant, as you have no doubt seen. This is only because he does not want to let anyone down. He will be your guide and take you as far as he can go. He paused again and looked at me expectantly. And what about the Chinese government? I asked. What are they doing? Why are they so interested in what is happening? The Lama lowered his eyes. I do not know. They seem to sense that something is happening with Shambhala. They have always tried to suppress Tibetan spirituality, but now they seem to have discovered our sect. You must be very careful. They fear us greatly. I looked away for a moment, still thinking about the Chinese. Have you decided? He asked. You mean whether to go? He smiled compassionately. Yes. I don't know. I'm not sure I have the courage to risk losing everything. The Lama just kept looking at me and nodded. You said some things about the challenge of my generation, I said. I still don't understand this. World War II, as well as the Cold War, the Lama began, was the previous generation's challenge to face. The great advances in technology had placed massive weapons in the hands of nations. In their nationalistic fervor, the forces of totalitarianism were attempting to conquer the democratic countries. This threat would have prevailed had not ordinary citizens fought and died in defense of freedom, ensuring the success of democracy in the world. But your task is different from that of your parents. The mission of your generation is different in its very nature from that of the World War II generation. They had to fight a particular tyranny with violence and arms. You must fight against the concepts of war and enemies altogether. But it takes just as much heroism. Do you understand? There was no way your parents could have done what they did, but they persevered. So must you. The forces of totalitarianism have not gone away. They are just not expressing themselves any longer through nations seeking empire. The forces of tyranny now are international and much more subtle, taking advantage of our dependence on technology and credit and a desire for convenience. Out of fear, they seek to centralize all technological growth into the hands of a few, so that their economic positions can be safeguarded and the future evolution of the world controlled. Opposing them with force is impossible. Democracy must be guarded now with the next step in freedom's evolution. We must use the power of our vision and the expectations that flow out from us as a constant prayer. This power is stronger than anyone now knows, and we must master it and begin to use it before it is too late. There are signs that something is changing in Shambhala. It's opening, shifting. The Lama was looking at me with steely determination. You must answer the call to Shambhala. It is the only way to honor what your forefathers have done before you. His comment filled me with anxiety. What do I do first? I asked. Complete the extensions of your energy, the Lama replied. This will not be easy for you because of your fear and anger. But if you persist, the gateway will present itself to you. The gateway? Yes. Our legends say that there are several gateways into Shambhala. One in the eastern Himalayas, in India, one to the northwest on the border of China, and one in the far north, in Russia. The signs will guide you to the right one. When all seems lost, look for the Dakini. As the Lama was talking, Yen walked outside with our packs. Okay, I said, feeling increasingly terrified. I'll try. Even as I spoke, I couldn't believe the words were coming from my mouth. Don't worry, Lama Rigdon said. Yen will help you. Just remember that before you can find Shambhala, you must first extend the level of energy that emanates from you and goes out into the world. You can't have success until you do. You must master the force of your expectations. I looked at Yen, and he half smiled. It's time, he said. Three. Cultivating energy. We walked outside, and I noticed a brown hardtop Jeep, perhaps 10 years old, sitting beside the road. As we walked closer, I could tell it was filled with ice chests, boxes of dried food, sleeping bags, and heavier jackets. Several external gas tanks were strapped to the rear. Where did all this stuff come from? I asked. He winked at me. We have been preparing for this journey for a long time. From Lama Rigdon's monastery, Yen headed north for a few miles and then turned the Jeep from the wide gravel road onto a narrow track, barely wider than a footpath. We continued driving for several miles without saying anything. The truth was, I didn't know what to say. I had agreed to go on this journey purely because of the Lama's word and because of what Will had done for me in the past, but now the angst over the decision was beginning to set in. I tried to shake off the fear and to retrace in my mind all that Lama Rigdon had told me. What did he mean by mastering the force of my expectations? I looked over at Yen. He was staring intently at the road. Where are we heading? I asked. Without looking at me, he said, this is a shortcut to the Friendship Highway. We must go southwest to Tingri, near Mount Everest. The drive will take most of the day. We will also be going up in altitude. Is that area safe? Yin glanced at me. We will be very careful. We are going to find Mr. Han. Who is he? He knows the most about the first extension of prayer energy you must learn. He is from Thailand, and he is very educated. I shook my head and looked away. I'm not sure I understand these extensions. What are they? You know that you have an energy field, correct? A prayer field flowing out from you all the time. Yes. And you know that this field has an effect on the world, on what happens. You know it can be either small and weak or extensive and strong. Yes, I suppose. Well, there are precise ways to extend and expand your field so that you can become more creative and powerful. The legends say that eventually all humans will know how to do this. But you must do it now if you expect to get to Shambhala and find Will. Can you already perform these extensions? I asked. Yin frowned. I did not say that. I just looked at him. This was great. How was I supposed to learn to do this if even Yin had trouble? For hours we drove without talking, eating nuts and vegetables as we rode along, stopping only once at a truck stop for gas. Well after dark, we passed through Tengri. We must be very careful here, Yin said. We are near the Rongfu Monastery and the Everest Base Camp, and there will be Chinese soldiers observing the tourists and climbers. But we will also be able to see incredible views of the north face of Everest. Yin made several turns until he came to an area of old wooden buildings. Beyond them was a simple mud brick house. The yard around Han's dwelling was immaculate, with carefully planted beds and rock gardens. As we drove up, a large man in a colorful hand-embroidered robe walked out on the stoop. He appeared to be in his 60s, but he moved like a person much younger. His head was completely shaved. Yin waved as the man strained to see who it was. When he recognized Yin, he burst into a smile and walked toward us as we got out of the jeep. The two men spoke for a moment in Tibetan. Then Yin pointed to me and said, "This is my American friend." I told Han my name, and he bowed slightly and grasped my hand. "Welcome," he said. "Please, come in." As Han walked back to the house, Yin reached inside the jeep and grabbed his pack. "Bring the satchel," he said. The house inside was modest but filled with colorful Tibetan paintings and rugs. We went into a small sitting area, and from where I was, I could see most of the other rooms. To the left was a small kitchen and a bedroom, and to the right was another room that had the look of a treatment area of some kind. In the center of the room was a massage or examination table, and lining one wall were cabinets and a small sink. Yin said something else to Han in Tibetan, and I heard him repeat my name. Han leaned forward with new alertness. He glanced over at me and took a large breath. "You are very fearful," Han said, looking me over closely. "No kidding," I replied. Han chuckled at my sarcasm. "We must do something about that if you are going to complete your journey." He walked around me, surveying my body. "Those in Shambhala," he began, "live differently from most other humans. They always have. In fact, through the millennia, there has been a great gulf between the energy levels of most people and those in Shambhala. Yet, in recent times, as all humans have evolved and increased their consciousness, this distance has closed, but it is still very far apart." As Han was talking, I glanced at Yin. He seemed to be as nervous as I was. Han picked up on it too. "Yin is as fearful as you are," he said. "But he knows this fear can be handled. I don't think you realize that yet. You must begin to act and think as those in Shambhala do. You must first cultivate and then stabilize your energy." Han stopped and concentrated on looking at my body again, then smiled. "You have had many experiences," he said. "You should be stronger." "Maybe I don't understand energy well enough," I replied. "Oh, no. You understand." Han smiled broadly. "You just don't want to change the way you live. You want to get excited about the ideas and then live unconsciously, more or less the way you've always done." This conversation was not going the way I wanted, and my fear was being replaced by a mild irritation. As I stood there, Han walked around me several more times, still gazing intently up and down my body. "What are you looking at?" I asked. "When I am assessing someone's energy level, I first look at posture." Han said matter-of-factly, "Yours is not too bad at this point, but you had to work on it, didn't you?" His question was very perceptive. As a youth, I grew very quickly one year, and as a result, slumped terribly. My back was always tired and ached, and it only improved when I began to practice a few basic yoga positions every morning. "The energy still doesn't flow up your body very well," Han added. "You can tell that by looking at me," I responded, "and by feeling you." The amount and strength of your energy feels like the degree of presence you have in the room. Surely you must have experienced someone who came into a room and had presence or charisma. Sure, of course. I thought again about the man at the hotel pool in Kathmandu. The more energy one has, the more others feel that person's presence. Often, this is energy that winds up being displayed through the ego, and so feels strong at first, then dissipates very rapidly. But with others, this is a genuine and constant energy that remains reliable. I nodded. One thing in your favor is that you are open, Han continued. You have experienced a mystical opening, a sudden inner flow of divine energy sometime in the past, have you not? Yes, I said, remembering my experience on the mountaintop in Peru. Even now it remained vivid in my memory. I had been at the end of my rope, certain I was about to be killed by Peruvian soldiers, when all of a sudden I was imbued with an unusual calm, euphoria, and lightness. It was the first time I had experienced what the mystics of various religions have called a transformative state. How did the energy fill you? Han asked. How did it happen, exactly? It was a rush of peacefulness, and all my fear went away. How did it move? That was a question I had never thought about, but I quickly began to remember. It seemed to come up my spine and out through the top of my head, lifting my body upward. I felt as if I was floating, as though there was a string pulling me upward from the top of my head. Han nodded approvingly, then caught my eye. And how long did it last? Not long, I replied. But I have learned how to breathe in the beauty around me in order to rekindle the feeling. What is missing in your practice, said Han, is breathing in the energy and then consciously maintaining it at a higher level. This is the first extension that you must make. You must keep your energy flowing in more fully. This must be done in a precise manner, taking care that your other actions do not erode your energy field once you have built it up. He paused for a moment. Do you understand? The rest of your life must support your higher energy. You must be congruent. He glanced at me mischievously. You must live wisely. Let's eat. He disappeared into the kitchen and returned with a platter of vegetables accompanied by a sauce of some kind. He ushered both Yen and me over to a table and served the vegetables in three small bowls. It soon became clear that the food was all part of the information Han was imparting. As we ate, he continued, maintaining higher energy within oneself is impossible if one consumes dead matter as food. I looked away, turning off. If this was going to be a lecture on diet, I would just as soon skip it. My attitude seemed to infuriate Han. Are you crazy? He almost shouted. Your very survival may depend on this information, and you won't put yourself out a little bit to learn this? What do you think? That you can live any way you want and still do important things? He became quiet and glanced sideways at me. I realized that the anger was genuine, but also a part of his act. I got the impression that he was giving information to me on more than one level. As I looked back at him, I couldn't help smiling. Han was eminently likable. He patted my shoulder and smiled back at me. Most people, he continued, are full of energy and enthusiasm in their youth, but then during middle ages they lapse into a slow downhill slide they pretend not to notice. After all, their friends are slowing down and their kids are active, so they spend more and more time sitting around and eating the foods that taste good. Before long, they begin to have nagging complaints and chronic problems such as digestive difficulties or skin irritations that they write off as just age, and then one day they get a serious illness that won't go away. Usually, they go to a doctor who does not stress prevention, and they begin to take drugs, and sometimes the problem is helped and sometimes it isn't. And then, as the years fly by, they get some disease that progressively gets worse, and they realize they are dying. The only solace is that they think what is happening occurs to everyone, that it is inevitable. The terrible thing is that this collapse of energy happens to some extent even to people who otherwise intend to be spiritual. He leaned over toward me and feigned looking around the room to see if someone was listening. This includes some of our most respected lamas. I wanted to laugh, but I dared not. If we seek higher energy and at the same time consume foods that rob us of this energy, Han continued, we get nowhere. We must assess all the energies we routinely allow into our own energy fields, especially foods, and avoid all but the best if our fields are to stay strong. He leaned closer to me again. This is very difficult for most people because we are all addicted to the foods we currently eat, and most are horribly poisonous. I looked away. I know there is much conflicting information out there about food, he went on, but the truth is out there too. Each of us must do the research, make ourselves see the larger picture. We are spiritual beings who come into this world to raise our energy. Yet much of what we find here is designed purely for sensual pleasure and distraction, and much of it saps our energy and pulls us toward physical disintegration. If we really believe we are energetic beings, we must follow a narrow path through these temptations. If you look all the way back at evolution, you see that from the beginning we had to experiment with food purely by trial and error, just to figure out which foods were good for us and which would kill us. Eat this plant, survive. Eat that one there, die. At this point in history, we've figured out what kills us, but we're only now realizing which foods add to our ultimate longevity and keep our energy high, and which ones ultimately wear us down. He paused for a moment, as if determining whether I was understanding. In Shambhala, they see this larger picture, he continued. They know who we are as human beings. We look like we are material stuff, flesh and blood, but we are atoms, pure energy. Your science has proved this fact. When we look deeper into atoms, we first see particles, and then at deeper levels, the particles themselves disappear into patterns of pure energy, vibrating at a certain level. And if we look at the way we eat from this perspective, we see that what we put in our bodies as food affects our vibrational state. Certain foods increase our energy and vibration, and others diminish it. The truth is as simple as that. All disease is the result of a drop in vibrational energy, and when our energy drops to a certain point, there are natural forces in the world that are designed to disincorporate our bodies. He looked at me as though he had said something very profound. Do you mean physically disincorporate? I asked. Yes. Look again at the larger picture. When anything dies, a dog hit by a car, or a person after a long illness, the cells of the body immediately lose their vibration and become very acid in chemistry. That acid state is the signal to the microbes of the world, the viruses, the bacteria, and fungi, that it is time to decompose this dead tissue. This is their job in the physical universe, to return a body back to the earth. As I said earlier, he went on, that when our bodies drop in energy because of the kinds of food we were eating, it makes us susceptible to disease. Here's how that works. When we eat foods, they are metabolized and leave a waste or ash in our bodies. This ash is either acidic in nature or alkaline, depending on the food. If it is alkaline, then it can be quickly extracted from our bodies with little energy. However, if these waste products are acid, they are very hard for the blood and lymph system to eliminate, and they are stored in our organs and tissues as solids, low vibrational crystalline forms that create blocks or disruptions in the vibratory levels of our cells. The more such acid byproducts are stored, the more generally acid these tissues become. And guess what? He looked at me dramatically again. A microbe of one type or another appears and senses all this acid and says, oh, this body is ready to be decomposed. Do you get that? When any organism dies, its body quickly changes to a highly acid environment and is consumed by microbes very quickly. If we begin to resemble this very acid or death state, Then we begin to come under attack from microbes. All human diseases are the result of such an attack. What Han was saying made perfect sense. A long time ago, I had run across some information about body pH on the internet. Moreover, I seemed to know it intuitively. You're telling me that what we eat directly sets us up for disease? I asked. Yes. The wrong foods can lower our vibrational level to the point that the forces of nature begin to return our bodies to the earth. What about diseases that aren't caused by microbes? All disease comes through microbial action. Your own research in the West is showing that. Various microbes have been found to be associated with the arterial lesions of heart disease, as well as the production of tumors and cancer. But remember, the microbes are just doing what they do. Diets that create the acidic environment are the true cause. He paused and then said, grasp this fully. We humans are either in an alkaline, high-energy state, or we are in an acid state, which signals the microbes living within us or that come by that we are ready to decompose. Disease is literally a rotting of some part of our bodies because the microbes around us have been given the signal that we are already dead. He looked at me mischievously. Sorry to be so blunt, he said, but we don't have much time. The food we eat determines almost entirely which of these two conditions we are in. Generally, foods that leave acid wastes in our body are heavy, overcooked, overprocessed, and sweet, such as meats, flours, pastries, alcohol, coffee, and the sweeter fruits. Alkaline foods are greener, fresher, and more alive, such as fresh vegetables and their juices, leafy greens, sprouts, and fruits like avocado, tomato, grapefruit, and lemons. It could not be more simple. We are spiritual beings in an energetic spiritual world. Those of you in the West might have grown up thinking that cooked meat and processed foods are good for us, but we know now that they create an environment of slow disincorporation that takes its toll on us over time. All the debilitating illnesses that plague mankind, arteriosclerosis, stroke, arthritis, AIDS, and especially cancers, exist because we pollute our bodies, which signals the microbes inside that we are ready to break down, de-energize, die. We always wondered why some people exposed to the same microbes don't get a particular disease. The difference is the inner body environment. The good news is, even if we have too much acidity in our bodies and begin to decompose, the situation can be reversed if we improve our nutrition and move to an alkaline, higher energy state. He was now waving both arms, his eyes wide, still twinkling. We are living in the dark ages when it comes to the principles of a vibrant, high energy body. Human beings are supposed to live more than 150 years, but we eat in a way that immediately begins to destroy us. Everywhere, we see people who are disincorporating before our eyes. But it doesn't have to be that way. He paused and took a breath. It's not that way in Shambhala.